Okay, the first thing I would like you to do is to reread this statement that I showed you yesterday in class, and take a few minutes to go to the website and answer the four questions that I've posed to you, essentially sort of reviewing what we learned yesterday and sort of hopefully establishing the larger patterns of the 1920s in your head, and then showing me that you actually can see evidence of this larger pattern. So if you would do that first, and then we'll pick up where we left off yesterday. Okay, I think we could safely say that the 1920s saw pretty profound changes in the way young people behaved and the way they conducted themselves in the public sphere. So what we saw in the 1920s was young college students, mostly affluent folks at this point, rejecting the social mores of their parents, a true rejection of the Victorian ideology of earlier periods. And they did this by throwing parties, drinking bootleg liquor, attending jazz clubs, dancing the Charleston. If you click on the picture of the folks there dancing the Charleston in the bottom right, or the hyperlink to the YouTube videos over on the left above Freud's head, you can actually watch people doing the Charleston. It became a huge dance craze in the 1920s, and there's some pretty funny pictures of people actually dancing the Charleston on the tops of cars and the tops of airplanes. It became really just sort of a cultural phenomenon. And what I'd like you to pay attention to as you're watching that video is how women are dressed and how women are behaving and how different that was from an earlier time. Also in this period, Freud had published in Austria and his work had been translated into English, and he became, quite popular in the United States in the 1920s. And I've mentioned several times that Freud is the guy who we get the Oedipus complex from, that he said, that we're all innately bisexual and we want to have sex with our mothers if we're males and fathers if we're female. Most of Freud's work has been discredited, but it was widely accepted during the 1920s. And it's not necessarily profound that people, well, I guess it is profound that people were talking about this stuff. But I'm sorry, people may have believed this stuff. But what was more profound was that people were actually talking about it. So the 1920s saw people actually talking about sex, which was a pretty dramatic change from earlier periods, and actually sometimes even engaging in it. This is the age of casual dating. It's the first time that young people actually engaged in casual dating on a regular basis. Before this, really young people would court. And courting was really trying to find somebody to marry, and it was often supervised. It was really designed to lead to marriage, whereas in the 1920s, young people start to casually date. Rather than actually looking for a husband, you might just hang out with your boyfriend for some time until you bore of him and move on to somebody else more exciting, and do that possibly several times before you actually settle down into marriage. Don't assume, though, that this meant profound changes for the ideal woman in the period. Women who boasted of sexual adventure would certainly be considered fast in this period, and fast was not a good label for a young lady to have. It would have been quite shameful. So although there were some pretty profound changes in the behavior of men and women and how they interacted together in public, women were still expected to be chaste, and so there was still a pretty profound double standards. Men might boast of their sexual adventures, but women should not engage in such behavior. Despite that, short skirts were becoming shorter. The ideal body type of young women changed in this period. I'll show you some pictures to support that in just a minute. And women started smoking, which really actually seems kind of unexciting to us, but at the time really was a step forward for women because it really showed independence and it challenged sort of what was seen as acceptable behavior in the earlier period. So take a second to watch some people dancing the Charleston, and then go ahead and move to the next slide for me, please. So the changing ideas of womanhood and actually just changing attitudes towards behavior in public can be seen in these images here. I think what you see here on the right-hand side, the woman with the sort of boa around her, she reflects sort of the ideal woman of the 1920s. She's wearing a fairly short skirt, not so much by our standards, but certainly by 1920s standards. The ideal body type has changed pretty profoundly. If you look at the woman in the upper right-hand corner with the bicycle, she would have been really edgy for her time in the early 1900s, 1910s. But notice the very small waist, the large bosom, the exaggerated hips, all made possible by her undergarments. All of that is gone in the 1920s, and women are wearing clothes that almost make them look like they have a boyish figure. There's quite a bit of female independence in this period. Women start driving cars independently, as I mentioned earlier. Women start smoking, which was pretty profound. We, as I've mentioned, casual dating and that type of thing. But it shouldn't be assumed that these changes to the idea of womanhood were universally accepted. Certainly not. If you look to the left, you have Amy Simple McPherson, who was an evangelist, a radio evangelist in the period, definitely an evangelical fundamentalist Christian who criticized these new ideas and behaviors that were associated with womanhood in the 1920s. She was phenomenally popular. She was based in Los Angeles, and she broadcast over the radio, and her message was widely accepted, so much so that by the end of the decade, 600 churches had been founded by her organization. At the same time, however, these changing attitudes towards women can be seen in both McPherson's photograph and in the photograph below that of the First Lady of the United States, it's Calvin Coolidge's wife there. Notice that the bobbed hair became almost universal. Even McPherson wears her hair cut up short, I think, although it's probably pulled up there. But nonetheless, both with the hair off their shoulders, and then you can't really see it because of the quote by F. Scott Fitzgerald there, but the First Lady is wearing a dress not unlike the woman to the right. It's obviously much more conservative, but nonetheless, it still hits her body shape in the same way as the woman to the right. Quite a bit different than the woman in the upper right-hand corner. Take a second to read this quote by F. Scott Fitzgerald. I think I read it in class, but it really does speak to the expansion of these new attitudes in the period. F. Scott Fitzgerald can really be seen sort of as the role model for the 1920s new attitudes towards youth, towards public behavior, towards womanhood. And here he sort of speaks to the fact that over time, through the 1920s, and here 1923 is actually the year he cites, that it moved out of simply just being youthful rebellion into more mainstream culture as middle-aged Americans started to join the party. Take a second to read that and then move on to the next slide for me. Okay, make sure you pause this so you can take a second to answer that question, and then move on to the slide with the Chesterfield cigarettes next. So the most enduring image of the 1920s is the flapper, and we can actually see in the flapper the source of these new attitudes towards women, and actually a lot of ways we can see the source of these new attitudes towards public behavior. The flapper was actually a product of the media. So this was a creation of journalists, fashion designers, and advertisers that became a reality over time as women and young men started to emulate what they were seeing in popular media. F. Scott Fitzgerald was a role model of the period. He actually created a lot of the sort of ideas about what it was to be young in the 1920s in his books, as we'll discuss in a minute. But this was also happening in other forms of media, in magazines and newspapers. Fashion designers were creating a new image that women quickly emulated, and advertisers like Maybelline and particularly the cigarette companies really created this image of what it was to be a woman in the 1920s. And it wasn't long before women started to emulate this image and young men started to emulate what they were seeing in the media, and this ideal became a reality. So the flapper was a product of the media created and then became actual reality over time and has proven to be the most enduring stereotype of the 1920s. Keep in mind, of course, as I've said several times, this doesn't reflect all women in the 1920s. This was really a sort of youthful rebellion, but in the last slide we saw that this youthful rebellion slowly moved and expanded into mainstream culture. It moved up into other age brackets, and even we see evidence of it starting to influence sort of mainstream culture with the photograph I showed you of the president's wife. But what was a flapper? So in the 1920s, like I said, media started to present this new image of womanhood, which we see in both the advertisements here for Chesterfield Cigarettes and Maybelline. The new woman had bobbed hair, so her hair was cut short. You see that particularly clearly in the Chesterfield cigarette ad. She smokes cigarettes, she wears lipstick, she wears short skirts. So this new sort of adventurous woman. And then the male counterpart that is reflected, and you saw that definitely in the video of people dancing the Charleston. So the youthful rebellion is created in the media and then slowly becomes the norm of the period, although it isn't universally accepted. It tends to be much more common in urban centers. You wouldn't have seen a lot of flappers in small town America. Okay, when we look at the literature of the 1920s, we see the larger pattern quite clearly of the 1920s being a tumultuous time, an age of contradictions. So let's start with F. Scott Fitzgerald. He wrote two very important works in this period, This Side of Paradise, which was published in 1920, and can really be seen as almost a guidebook for youthful rebellion. F. Scott Fitzgerald himself was like a role model or a perfect leader of the 1920s. He was very young, handsome in the period. His wife was beautiful, and they spent the 1920s really partying their way across Manhattan, Paris, and Rome. In The Great Gatsby, which was published in 1925, that theme continues as reveling in the party of the 1920s, the sort of celebration of what we would call the Roaring Twenties. But in The Great Gatsby, we start to see the contradictions of the period. And F. Scott Fitzgerald, the author, is a bit of a moralist, and that becomes clear in The Great Gatsby. Although he does glorify the age, he also highlights the problems in the age, increasing materialism, selfishness, and a casual disregard for the less fortunate. So even within Gatsby's work, we see the sort of contradictions of this period. We're celebrating having a great time, but at the same time, we feel a little bit guilty about it. Sinclair Lewis truly shows the contradiction. So if we compare F. Scott Fitzgerald's work to Sinclair Lewis's work, we would say that F. Scott Fitzgerald reveled in the sort of new ideas and the great party that was the 1920s, whereas Sinclair Lewis was angry with the problems of the 1920s. And so he really ran a social commentary where he criticized what he saw as problems with the decade. He rejected the moral pieties of the older generation. So in that way, he accepted the changes that were happening in the 1920s because he rejected the old morality, the old Victorian morality of earlier periods. But at the same time, he rejected the business pieties of the new generation. So he had problems with the increasing consumerism of the 1920s, with the increasing materialism of the 1920s. In his book, Main Street, which was published in 1920, he took a very critical view of post-war America. In it, he satirized the smugness and cultural barrenness of a fictional Midwestern town. So in that, he kind of attacked America, and he attacked the old ways in the small town America setting. So it seems in there, he kind of supports the idea of change, moral change and cultural change in the 1920s. But in his book, Babbitt, which was published in 1922, he attacks big city life. And in this book, he really feels that there's problems with the increasing conformity and universalism of American culture that becomes evident in urban America. So Sinclair Lewis does attack both the old ways that are widely under attack in the 1920s by other writers and musicians and social commentators, but he also attacks the new ways of the 1920s of being overly conformist, and he feels increasingly uncomfortable with the new universal culture that is emerging in the 1920s. Meanwhile, we have another social commentary running, which is a product of the First World War. Last year in world history, we talked a lot about how the First World War shapes popular culture in the post-war period around the world, particularly in Europe. That same thing was happening in the United States with the work of Ernest Hemingway. Although most of those books that Ernest Hemingway, although he was American, he was actually writing them in Europe during the time period. Ernest Hemingway had volunteered for the Red Cross during the First World War and had gotten injured. After the war was over, he remained in Paris. And in Paris in 1921, he wrote The Sun Also Rises. And what The Sun Also Rises does is it really talks about how the war damaged the individual. It's the story of American and English youth drifting sort of through Spain in the post-war period. And it really demonstrates how the war was incredibly damaging to individuals. In 1929, he wrote A Farewell to Arms. And in that book, he depicts war's futility in general, and the fact that politicians, when they speak of war, are just full of empty rhetoric, and he expresses his frustration with war and materialism that follows the war. So if we have F. Scott Fitzgerald as sort of the man who celebrates the change of the 1920s with a quiet commentary about its materialism and selfishness, then we have Sinclair Lewis, who is really on the attack in the period. He's frustrated with this tumultuous time. He sees problems everywhere. And Ernest Hemingway, particularly frustrated with the violence of war, the futility of war, but also increasingly concerned about the rising materialism of the period. So, like I said, I think the literature of this period really speaks to the swinging pendulum. In some aspects, it supports this new culture, but in other ways, it attacks the new culture. It reflects the tumultuous time that was the 1920s. So let's go ahead and switch to the next slide, please. Okay, take some time to answer that question and read the quote from Ernest Hemingway, which I really think speaks to what I'm arguing about his work in the period. And then go ahead and, when you're done with that, move on to the journalism slide so that we can discuss that. Okay, journalism in the 1920s, like all aspects of the media in the 1920s, reflected the incredible diversity of the period and the contradictions of the period. The American Mercury was started in 1924. It was published by a guy named Henry Mankin. And it really took a sort of Sinclair Lewis approach to the decade. Mankin was highly critical of the 1920s, and many historians argue that his publication could have been seen as the Bible of the decade's alienated intellectuals. He ridiculed small-town America as being backwards. He attacked Protestant fundamentalism as being outdated. He even attacked middle-class America. He called middle-class America boobsies. So he was critical, like Sinclair Lewis, of the materialism and consumer culture that had taken over America's cities. He attacked all politicians. You can see from his quotes here, which I think are pretty funny, that he had little patience for politics. So take a second to read through those quotes, if you would. He attacked America in general, and when he was asked at one point why he stayed in America, because he was so critical of pretty much everything in the period, he said, "I stay in America for the same reason that people visit zoos. So we have this strong political commentary, social commentary that's running throughout the period, further contributing to these sort of radical swings of the pendulum, both directions. Here we have Mankin really attacking everything American, and really upset with the period, which further supports that this period was truly a tumultuous time. So let's go ahead and transition to the next slide, if you would. Okay, so there's several different sort of trends running in American artwork in the 1920s. One is the continuation of the regionalist genre that we discussed in the previous period in literature starts to be reflected in artwork in the 1920s. So we have several regionalist artists, among them this man, Thomas Hart Benton, but also Grant Woods, perhaps one of the most famous regionalists of the period, and John Curry. So we have lots of artists doing this sort of regional work. Regionalism basically is when the artist looks at their home, the area they live, and runs commentary on America from a regional perspective. And so in the case of Benton, he's from Missouri. And so he was well known for his paintings that depicted agricultural and industrial growth in Missouri. So these major changes that were happening in American life were set against a backdrop of agriculture and Midwestern, Mid-America architecture, really reflecting sort of this regionalist vibe in painting at the time. So this painting is called Boomtown, and it's set in Texas. Okay, so what we see here is Benton, again, reflecting sort of the change in America from a regionalist perspective. So Boomtown is a Texas oil town that sprang to life in 1926. And what we see here, I think, pretty clearly, and I actually really like this painting to sort of speak to the 1920s in general, is both the changes and continuities in the period. So we have this seemingly small town in Texas, but what we realize is that it, from the name and from what we see in the background, is that it not only does it show sort of small town America, which is a continuity from earlier periods, but what we actually see is the profound changes of the 1920s. So in the background, you see the smoke rising. The smoke actually symbolizes progress, and we see electricity running through the town, the Model T. The bustle in this small town as it grows as an oil center in the West. They actually were able to produce 5,000 gallons a day in this it's Borger, Texas, and so that's actually what Thomas Benton is reflecting here, is this sort of explosion in the period of this new technology of electricity and oil and the petroleum that fueled the Model Ts that became so huge in the period. So we actually, what's kind of neat in this painting is that we see the changes in American society from the perspective of the small town in America. Another theme very common in 1920s artwork is a reflection of the same kind of commentary that we see in the literature of Sinclair Lewis. Here we have a painting by Edward Hooper. It's Sunday is the name of the painting, and it's really a commentary on this new urban life that has taken hold in America. I think it's really one of my favorite paintings from the period. And what we see is this man living in an urban center, but very, very alone. And that reflects the sort of bleakness of urban life that many people felt in a the new urban setting in America. So we mentioned that several of the sort of critics of this period, particularly people like Sinclair Lewis, were becoming increasingly concerned with the sort of growing conformity of America, growing materialism of urban America. And that's actually, I think, what Edward Hooper is doing a bit of a commentary here on as well, is you're alone in a crowd. So this man sits in an urban center, but the streets are empty. He's all alone. And America is changing, and the individual is being lost in the bustle of the changes of America. Remember that when we discussed yesterday the rise of celebrity culture, I made the point that for some historians, they see the rise of celebrity culture in America as being a reflection of individuals feeling lost in this rising universal culture that dominated America in the 1920s, the rising sort of push to conformity and universalism. And I think that we see that again here in Edward Hooper's painting, Sunday. The individual feels lost in the great change. Also, I think we can look at this painting another way, and we could potentially see this as a small town in America and how small town America is slowly vanishing and making way for a much more urban society that is replacing the small towns. And so sort of center of culture, we know in the 1920s, shifted to the urban centers, because this is the first time in American history where more Americans live in major cities than they do in rural areas. So art in the 1920s, you should have transitioned to this photograph of the factory. So art in the 1920s, just like the literature of the 1920s, just like everything that's happening in this period, is full of contradictions, okay? Full of the swinging pendulum left and right. So if we looked at Edward Hooper Edward Hooper as somebody who's criticizing problems in the period, then we can look here at Charles Sheeler as celebrating the period. So it's almost like Hooper is the Sinclair Lewis, and Sheeler is the F. Scott Fitzgerald of the period. So Sheeler was actually commissioned by the Ford Corporation to take a series of photographs of their plant in Detroit, Michigan. This is one of those photographs. So this guy was actually hired by Ford to take these photographs. And it really is a celebration of a technological utopia, a celebration of progress, a celebration of industry, a celebration of the great changes that the 1920s brought to America. In the 1920s, Sheeler was best known for his photographs. In the 1930s, he will be better known for his paintings. But those themes will continue that we see in the 1920s in his work. We'll see that again in the 1930s. But really here what we have again is a celebration of progress and of change that the 1920s brought. Okay, so this painting should look more familiar from the works that we looked at last year in world history from the 1920s. What we can see here is the influence of the European art movement, the Cubists, Picasso, and the like on American artists. So this is Joseph Stella's Brooklyn Bridge. He actually painted several images of the Brooklyn Bridge. This is just one of many. You can actually do a Google search of Stella Brooklyn Bridge, and you'll see about five versions of this kind of painting. He returned to this theme quite frequently. This type of artwork is what we call futurist. It's heavily influenced by the European Cubist movement. As you can see, that it does look quite a bit like the works of Picasso, but you can also clearly see sort of why the term futurist is used to describe it. And again, the subject matter here is the Brooklyn Bridge. If you take a little bit of time and kind of look at it, you'll quickly see that you do see the Brooklyn Bridge here in the image. Stella is sort of the school of celebrating the change and the excitement of the 1920s. And I think if you take some time to look at this painting, it starts to become quite apparent that he is celebrating the progress and the excitement of the changes that are coming in the 1920s. As I mentioned, Stella returned repeatedly to the subject of the Brooklyn Bridge. His frantic images reflected his personal experience living in Lower Manhattan as an immigrant. He had dueling feelings of sort of raw urban frustration mixed with profound awe for this industrial icon that was the Brooklyn Bridge. For Stella, the Brooklyn Bridge became a symbol of modern life, full of excitement and motion, while also representing stability and solidarity. So he really sort of speaks to the celebration of the changes in the culture of the 1920s. So again, this sort of pendulum swing where we have some people who are very uncomfortable with what's happening in the 1920s and other people who are very, very excited about it. Go ahead and transition to the next slide, please. Okay, so this painting is by Georgia O'Keeffe. You've probably seen a million Georgia O'Keeffe paintings of flowers. She's much more famous for painting flowers. You may not have realized she also painted urban settings. She actually moved to New York in 1918, and her work reflected sort of the allure and the congestion of the cities, the excitement of 1920s urban life. So what we hopefully are starting to notice here is a pattern that artists are being influenced by the increasing urbanization that is the 1920s. Go ahead and transition to the next image. Okay, so take a second to answer this question, see if you can sort of prove to me that you could use one of these paintings in a DBQ to support arguments about the 1920s. And then we'll move on and start talking about the Harlem Renaissance. Okay, as we've mentioned, the war years and into the 1920s saw massive migrations of African Americans from the South to northern cities. This happened across the North, from Detroit to Cleveland to New York. In New York, somewhere between 150, in New York, Harlem became the destination of large numbers of African Americans. In the late 19th century, Harlem was actually an elite suburb. It was sort of where the wealthy folks lived in the late 1800s. But then during the war, the population of Harlem swelled from 152,000 to 327,000 by the 1920s. And these were African Americans moving to Harlem from the South and from the West Indies. So we got large numbers of Caribbean immigrants into Harlem in this period. So let's kind of talk about Harlem in general in the 1920s, and then we'll kind of move on and talk about how the Harlem Renaissance emerged in the midst of this new culture. First of all, you have a mixing culture in the period, because of course you have African Americans coming up from the South, but you also have Black influence from the West Indies, with a sizable Jamaican population moving into the area, and then, of course, the existing white population of Manhattan. The vast majority of African Americans who moved into Harlem were quite poor, and they worked in low-paid, unskilled jobs. But there was a small middle class made up of ministers, real estate agents, and funeral directors in Harlem. But like I said, the vast majority of people in Harlem were living in poverty. Harlem suffered from sort of typical problems with poverty, high rates of tuberculosis, high rates of infant mortality, and venereal disease. But despite these problems, Harlem sort of evolved into a very vibrant Black culture that was patronized and in some ways funded by the whites in other neighborhoods of Manhattan. So in the midst of this sort of new center of Black culture in the North, a sort of a cultural explosion occurred, largely funded and patronized by neighboring whites. So we got the rise of the Cotton Club, and at the Cotton Club, which was in Harlem, Black entertainers would entertain white audiences. And then we got the rise of a pretty huge literary movement in Harlem, which was also in many ways funded and patronized by whites. Charlotte Mason, who was a white woman who lived just south of Harlem in Manhattan, actually funded Langston Hughes and Zora Neale Hurst during the Harlem Renaissance. Okay, so let's go ahead and transition. We'll talk more in detail about the Harlem Renaissance. Okay, so in the 1920s, we saw this incredible flowering of culture in Harlem among African Americans. which touched as many fields of culture as we've seen in the white community, particularly literature and music being the most heavily influenced by this period. What we see in the Harlem Renaissance is sort of endemic of the larger, or typical, I should say, of the larger pattern of the 1920s. We see both people who are sort of reveling in the changes that are occurring in the 1920s, the celebration of life and enjoyment, but then we also see commentary about sort of these changes and criticism of these changes. So the sort of larger pattern of both comfort with change and concern for the lack of continuity exists here as well. What we see as a general pattern in Harlem Renaissance literature is ignoring the sort of problems with race and poverty and looking rather at a celebration of life and culture of African Americans. So that's kind of a general pattern of Harlem Renaissance literature, although just like anything in the 1920s, we see this change in the literature that where there's more of a celebration of celebrating the here and now and having a good time, but also we have the cultural commentary and criticism of that present as well. So let's start with Langston Hughes, The Weary Blues. This is a collection of it's a poem. I'm sorry, from 1920. He wrote about the world around him, and so in this he gave voice to African Americans during a time of segregation. He himself, of course, was a contributor, a huge contributor to the Harlem Renaissance as a poet, but he also patronized the work of other African Americans and supported the growth of literature in this period in general, even beyond his own work. Then we have Claude McKay, who actually is an example of the immigration of people from the Caribbean. Claude McKay was actually Jamaican. And here we have definitely an example of the sort of celebration of what Harlem was. In his book, Home to Harlem, he writes about Harlem's throbbing nightlife, the sort of sinister life that was the nightlife in Harlem. It tells the story of a guy who enlists in the U.S. Army, then deserts, and he makes his way back home to Harlem. He inspired several other authors who, like Eugene O'Neill, who went on to write additional works in this period. Next, let's talk about Nila Larson. She wrote Quicksand in 1928. In here, it tells the story of a mulatto woman who struggles with questions about race and sexuality. So again, you can see that there's both sides of the story here, both celebration of culture and change, but also concern, the traditional concerns of the African-American community. Alan Locke wrote, actually compiled, New Negro in 1925, and it's really seen as a landmark work. It's a collection of essays, poems, and short stories, all from the Harlem Renaissance. And he called the Harlem Renaissance really Black's coming of age, and the New Negro really was a compilation of literary works that proved that statement true, that the Harlem Renaissance was a Black coming of age. In general, again, the pattern is consistent with the larger pattern of the 1920s. We have both the reveling in change and concern for that change. The general pattern of ignoring the problems of race and poverty survives through about 1929, but after 1929, the African American community in Harlem starts to become much more politically engaged and starts to really challenge the oppression of African Americans more overtly in the literature of post-Harlem Renaissance. Go ahead and transition to the next slide, please. Okay, so the music of the Harlem Renaissance really is mostly jazz. We do have William Grant Steele, who's a sort of classical composer, African-American, working in Harlem, producing more classical work. But what's most famous out of the Harlem Renaissance and out of the 1920s in general is the rise of the jazz age. And so what continues from earlier periods but becomes even more pervasive is the patronage of black culture by whites in America. So we saw this earlier, of course, with ragtime, but it becomes even bigger in the 1920s as jazz becomes incredibly popular. So we mentioned earlier that this, you know, this huge dance craze that that swept the nation in the 1920s, the Charleston. We mentioned that earlier. That actually came out of the Harlem Renaissance with Runnin' Wild. So Runnin' Wild was an all-black revue that that performed in Harlem, and I believe it also performed in other areas as well. But it is what spawned the Charleston dance craze. So I'm going to play a little bit of that music for you now so you can hear that. Okay, so that particular version of Runnin' Wild was actually performed by Duke Ellington, who eventually becomes huge at the Cotton Club. You see that in the bottom left-hand corner of the slide. That's an album from Duke Ellington when he performed at the Cotton Club. That continues on into the 1930s, actually. Duke Ellington's pretty big through the 20s and the 30s. The Cotton Club really becomes kind of the center of all of this, the sort of the hub of the jazz age. So if I guess it's like, you know, if Nashville is the center of country music, Harlem was the center of the jazz age, and specifically the Cotton Club. Again, at the Cotton Club, it would have been all black performers for the most part, performing for all white audiences. African Americans were actually not allowed to be in the audience at the Cotton Club. So again, it kind of speaks to these contradictions that I keep arguing for the period. So you have whites coming into black neighborhoods to watch black performers who are creating nationwide dance crazes in clubs that are that have black entertainment, but all white audiences, and blacks aren't allowed to actually be in the audience. So it is, again, sort of this strange contradiction that ran and made the 1920s really a tumultuous time. I'm going to play a couple more examples of jazz music from the 1920s for you, so you can kind of get an idea of what this stuff sounded like and why it was so exciting. And then we'll move on to the next slide. Okay, what you're about to listen to right now is actually a recording of Duke Ellington performing at the Cotton Club. I believe this recording is actually maybe from the 1930s, but nonetheless, it's the same type of music, the same general idea. Nothing really changed as far as I was concerned with the Cotton Club as we moved into the 1930s. Thank you. Okay, again, that was Duke Ellington. Duke Ellington was actually, his orchestra was the house band at the Cotton Club from December of 1927 to June of 1931. And so the Cotton Club helped launch several other people's careers. So Fletcher Henderson, who performed, his band started performing in 1923 at the Cotton Club, and Jelly Roll Morton is another big guy who came out of this period. Okay, so let's go ahead and go to the next slide. Okay, so we're kind of moving out of Harlem and now into sort of America as a whole. And so what we see here is the incredible influence that African Americans had on white culture in this period. And so what happened is you had sort of the true pure jazz being performed by African Americans, and then whites performing either watered down versions of it for white audiences, which is what Paul Whiteman did. So I'll play, I'm not going to play any of that for you. Never mind. So Paul Whiteman sort of performed more mild, watered down jazz for white audiences. And then you had other whites who were trying to perform authentic jazz. And that's what we actually see with the original Dixieland Jazz Band, which came out of the South, debuted in New York City in 1917 and started quite a craze. So these are white folks trying to imitate black jazz performers from New Orleans. So let's take a second to listen to that. And then you had sort of more authentic jazz being performed by black performers like Louis Armstrong, Fats Waller, Duke Ellington, Gertrude May Rayner, and Bessie Smith. I'll play a bit of that for you now. Okay, that was Louis Armstrong playing the trumpet. Now we're going to... Hold on. Okay, sorry about that. And here's Bessie Smith performing in 1929. Okay, so those are just a few examples, but we have also sort of larger, moving away from jazz, we have Aaron Copland, performing music that's influenced by American folk tradition, Frederick Converse performing music that's inspired by the automobile. But definitely the biggest music coming out of this period is, of course, jazz, and it really, again, does speak to this larger pattern of sort of contradictions in the age of the Ku Klux Klan. You have Americans emulating black performers like the original Dixieland Jazz Band, and you also, to sort of support the other larger pattern in this period, you have the growth of a universal culture in America where you have large numbers of Americans listening to the same kind of music, this kind of music, on radios all over the country. Okay, so take a second to answer the last question, and then you are done for today. Thanks a lot.